You're listening to The Big Cast.
Hey, John, how's it going with data analytics in your organization?
You know what, John? We are having a blast over here at Partners.
Oh, cool. One of the things I feel like people need to do is to continually sharpen their saw as it relates to data analytics. Have you heard of our AXFI conference?
I have, John. You know, last year the team went and they came back raving about the conference.
What did they like about it?
Well, I think that there's kind of two big tracks. It's not just data analytics, but it's also innovation, that you get to see your peers present some of their ideas rather than theory, things that are actually happening. You know, John, this sounds like a conference that more than just your data analytics analytics team should come to. I mean, this is part of your senior team, your data analytics folks, maybe other members of your executive team. Hey, when's the conference this year? Have they scheduled it yet?
Yeah, for coming up in 2018, it's June 10th through the 13th in Minnesota. And get this, if you sign up right now, it's only $795, but that's only through October 31st. It's an early bird special.
Okay, so I've got like 3-4 weeks. I need to get on this. Where can I go to sign up?
You can go to www.axficonference.com. That's www.axficonference.com.
Great. I'll check it out. Thanks, John.
Welcome, everybody, and thanks for joining us for another episode of The Big Cast. My name is Glenn Sarvati from 154 Advisors, doing this in collaboration with the Best Innovation Group, where we like to do cool things with technology for credit unions, fintechs, and the financial services industry. We are here every Tuesday and most Thursdays with new content on those topics. I primarily focus on the payment space, but this week, it's a little broader than that, I would say. I am just back from Washington, D.C. and the annual CUNA Government Affairs Conference, which I have to say, I think CUNA outdid themselves this year. A very, very good action-packed event with an all-time high in terms of attendance as well. 5,200 people at the conference, primarily representing credit unions, also service providers involved in the industry. I guess I would consider myself as one of those. And probably the highest profile speaker, George W. Bush, came and spoke to us on Monday morning. And that may have been enough to tilt the balance in terms of taking us over the 5,000 mark to the largest audience that CUNA has had. And I kind of wondered beforehand which strings had to be pulled to actually get such a name get for the keynote speaker. Then I stepped back and realized when Jim Nussle, the chairman and CEO of CUNA, had mentioned in his introductory remarks, it all kind of made sense. Jim Nussle is a former congressman from Iowa, was also a budget director for the federal government, serving during the administration of George W. Bush. So they know each other quite well. In fact, Jim shared a story that going back to his days as an Iowa congressman, George W. Bush actually announced his candidacy for president initially from his district at a personal event that Jim Nussle had put together, obviously Iowa being one of the natural places to do that. And I got to say, I thought former President Bush's remarks were very worthwhile, very inspiring, and it just made me feel really good to see just how relaxed he looked. I mean, the weight that obviously comes off your shoulders after having had a duty and a responsibility like being the president for 8 years, especially in the period that he was serving, came across as very intelligent, very cogent. Again, really, really enjoyed hearing from him, and appreciate CUNA making the effort to make that possible to a big group of us to have that pleasure. Jim Nussle in his comments also shared some other. Oh, I should also just mention, I'm not just going to be talking. I'm going to be sharing some on-the-scene interviews that I did along the way. An economic update from CUNA's economists talking about how they see the economy playing out over the course of the next year or so. And then an additional interview I did on a very, very interesting panel that came up, a very well-attended one on a pretty darn critical topic that I don't believe gets nearly enough serious attention and conversation, and that's around the area of cannabis banking and banking of the companies who are involved in the legal distribution of marijuana for whether recreational or medicinal purposes. So that'll be coming up later in the podcast as well. Jim Nussle also shared in several different places some of the key challenges that he saw and just kind of laid out the land. Overall, a very positive message for credit unions. He mentioned that there have been 5 million new credit union members added in the year 2017. Growth in membership is continuing to run at highs that we haven't seen for quite some time. And we'll get into more of the numbers in that in the economic update. So I'll hold off on getting into more detail there. But the key challenges that he mentioned that in his kind of, you know, voice of the industry, kind of speaking and listening tours that he does around the country, he kind of laid these out, and I thought they were interesting, kind of falling into three buckets. The internal challenges that credit unions see, and this one, again, a little self-serving, but really nice to see. The war for talent, and talked about in terms of bringing in solid talent to be the representatives of the credit union and the face to the community. I just found that interesting. It's the very first thing that he mentioned in terms of challenges, and just so happens to be a recent podcast that my colleague John Jankley is here at the Big Cast had just put out and did a whole piece on that. So I'll post a link to the War for Talent so you can have a listen to John's take on that one. The other ones from an internal standpoint that Jim Nussel mentioned were data security. Again, not a whole big surprise there. Plenty of conversation on that front. And compliance. And that one kind of ties into the external factors as well, those being regulation and taxation. And one of the things I'll also mention on that regard is the GAC. I think I said this already, but that stands for Government Affairs Conference. CUNA has a couple of major annual events. This is the one that, for a very good reason, takes place in Washington, D.C., because after 2 days of sessions and an exhibit hall where you can see the latest technologies, et cetera, the goal for Wednesday is for the credit union executives, board members who attend, to hike the hill, as it's called, and visit their representatives, their elected representatives from their states and their districts, and really provide a grassroots message in terms of showing the importance and the strength of the credit union voice and why credit unions should be supported in legislation. The big focus this year specifically was a law that's a bill that's in process right now called S2155, 2155, the Economic Growth, Regulatory Relief, and Consumer Protection Act. We can post some more details to that, but I think it ties into something that CUNA has been spending a lot of energy on over the last couple of years, the whole notion of common sense regulation, that regulation should not be one size fits all, that there are obvious reasons where smaller institutions can be handled differently and don't need to have the same burdensome requirements placed on them that multi-billion dollar entities that are involved in far more complex financial instruments I probably have much better reason to be worrying about those things. So that was the focus of a lot of the conversations that took place on the Hill. Another big focus that he mentioned is the continuing battle to get the message out to the masses with regard to credit unions, the relevance and awareness. And we'll come back to that one as well, because there's a new branding campaign and media campaign that was introduced at the conference, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But more specifically, as I mentioned, one of the sessions, along with the general sessions, a series of congressmen, representatives, current budget director Nick Mulvaney came and spoke for about 10, 15 minutes. Some very inspirational speakers from outside the industry as well. We had, you know, all of this in a general session, which is very valuable. Also, breakout sessions. And the annual one that is, in my mind, one of the most popular, clearly it is because it gets one of the biggest rooms, and it also is the only breakout session that's offered twice, is the economic update, as I mentioned, done by CUNA's economists, taking a look at what they see is reading the tea leaves, where the economy is going in the near future, and what that means for the credit union industry. So full disclosure, I did not get a chance to see that one for the first time this year. I think I've got a pretty good excuse. I was actually speaking in another breakout session at the same time for one of them. And then the other one, I went in to gather the information around the cannabis banking segment that we're going to do a little bit later in the episode. But two economists from CUNA, Mike Schenck and Jordan Van Rien, graciously agreed to stay afterwards. I caught their Q&A, had a chance to take a look at their presentation and have a conversation without the benefit of actually having seen the whole thing from the stage. But maybe that puts me in the similar set of shoes as you, so we could listen to some of this stuff kind of for the first time together. So take a listen to Mike and Jordan and their take on the economic outlook for the country's economy as well as credit unions. Glenn Cervata here at CUNA GAC with Mike Schenck and also Jordan Van Rien, who just did their economic update for the year. And I know this is always one of the best. If you can tell, it's one of the largest rooms, and you actually do it twice. So obviously, always one of the more popular breakout sessions here. So thanks for taking the time. Again, a positive story, obviously, on the credit union front with the closeout of the special contingency fund and record growth for some period of time at both members and loan growth, correct?
Pretty solid growth. It's not record growth, but it's growth levels that we haven't seen in quite some time. So that's really helpful. The economy is in pretty good shape overall. The unemployment rate is 4.1%. We're near full employment. We're at full employment, depending on your point of view. And incomes are going up at a pretty good pace. That means that people have money to spend, and they're confident, and they're more interested in borrowing money. More willing to spend on big ticket items, and so therefore they need their credit unions.
And I saw it was a 10% loan growth each of the last 4 years in the credit union space?
Right. We've had, we only have data through the third quarter at the moment of 2017, but I guarantee you
it's on that run rate.
When we get to the end of 2000, we'll have four consecutive years of 10% growth. And as I mentioned in the presentation, you got to go back 30 years to see four consecutive years that are that strong. It's really eye-popping.
And part of that is because there's also more members as well.
Right. The membership roles have been increasing at an increasing rate. And overall growth came in a little bit north of 4% last year or over the last 12 months. In context, that's relative to a population that's growing 0.8%.
It's a good way of looking at it.
So, right. Yeah, it's we're growing memberships five times faster than population growth. People recognize the value of credit unions, recognize the difference that they can make in their lives. I think appreciate the sort of the consultative approach that credit unions take to their lending decisions, their ability and willingness to listen to your story. A lot of people during the downturn were dinged pretty badly, and in many cases through no fault of their own. And so it really is helpful and noticeable from the consumer vantage point that there are these institutions out there that aren't making credit decisions based on some criteria established four or five states away at a headquarters that they'll never go to.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty powerful.
Another piece of good news was actually a piece of status quo, actually, right, in terms of maintaining the tax exempt status for credit unions.
Yeah, we felt like we hit it out of the ballpark with that one. the tax code was basically open for a year.
Yeah.
And we know of no serious attempt to throw credit unions into the mix. Might have been some discussion behind closed doors, but we weren't aware of it. We were totally engaged the whole time. We were delivering a message that I think is quite powerful. The tax exemption represents an expenditure to the federal government of $2.7 billion in the last tax year. We estimate that the benefits that credit unions delivered in the marketplace far exceed that $2.7 billion. So in other words, that 2.7
money well spent
is money very well spent. It serves as an inducement for credit unions to maintain the cooperative structure, which, our charter is, there are a few warts on the charter. Field of membership, member business lending cap, all that sort of thing. And yet we sort of muddle through with that flawed charter. Part of the reason we do it is because of the
not
tax
to
exemption.
Reopen this one. Yeah.
And that cooperative structure with no shareholders means we take profits and we deliver them right back to members. And so $14.2 billion direct benefit, lower rates on loans, lower fees and fewer fees, and then higher yields on savings accounts. It adds up to a significant amount.
So that's the 14.2 is what you would stack up against the 2.7. So
yep.
Kind of a more than a 5X, I guess,
right.
Multiplier.
Wow. Absolutely.
Impressive. Another piece of good news in terms of money and savings is the share insurance fund also coming back, correct?
Right. The average credit union, rather than facing in the aggregate approximately $1.4 billion premium this year, because of the closure of the stabilization fund and the merger of the stabilization fund into the share insurance fund, the average credit union will get something in the neighborhood of 6 to 7 basis points uninsured shares back this year, 2018.
And again, just as a refresher course on this, this dates back to the financial crisis and additional money set aside to help deal with troubled assets and other types of remediation, correct?
Correct. Right. Yep.
So the other things, Jordan, we talked about this a bit as well, in terms of lending, home equity lending, auto lending, again, both going strong. But you know, I guess one of the questions for both of you is, you know, good times going. How long do we see? Obviously, forecasting is an imprecise science, but how long do we see these good times continuing?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, our forecasts go out, you know, about a year or two at the most. It's pretty hard to see much farther than that. But we see, you know, loan demand staying pretty strong. If you look back at auto lending, for example, there were a lot of auto loans that would have been done during the recession that weren't because people just couldn't get a loan and they were in a tough position. So there's still quite a bit of pent-up demand from the recession that we expect to still fuel auto loan growth, at least for the next year or two. We do see some things shifting in the market in the long run, of course, you know, more kind of Uber, Lyft, and self-driving cars and things like that. That could affect auto loan demand in the long run, but for the next year or two, we think it's still going to stay strong. Interest rates are going up a little bit. That'll continue. We think the Fed will increase rates, you know, three or four times this year. So that should bring back loan demand a little bit, especially for maybe, you know, home equity, mortgages. But at the same time, tax cuts, people have a lot more money, unemployment's at its lowest rate in a long time, and the economy is doing great. So people are spending a lot, they're consuming a lot. So we expect that demand to stay pretty strong, but maybe drop off just a little bit from what it was this past year.
So even sometime in 2018 may start at least decelerating a bit?
Decelerating. We see, you know, the growth continuing, but maybe at a little bit lower rate than it's gone in 2017.
Yeah, I heard one of the examples during the questions and answers at the end of the session, which I thought was interesting, is the whole idea of, you know, down the road, I think you said it's more the second half of the 2020s where you're going to see the impact of self-driving cars and things that may change demand for auto purchases. But even today, with the ability for Uber, you know, you do wind up maybe with some two-car families, maybe becoming one-car families.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's what I see a lot in Madison. You know, it's a college town. A lot of people now are using Uber, Lyft, you know, and between that, public transportation, using a bike. A lot of families that I think before would have had two cars, you know, maybe only have one. A lot of young people love living downtown, you know, at the university, feel like they don't want to have the hassle of a car. So yeah, I think you have a lot of big generation of young people now that are not thinking the same way we thought of, you know, as a vehicle, you know, that everybody has their vehicle. But now many young people, you know, they like living downtown. They like taking Uber, Lyft. They don't have to pay, you know, the monthly amount. They don't have to keep up maintenance or anything like that, do the oil changes. So in some sense, it's a bit of freedom for them. But, you know, at some point, most of these young people do end up having a family, you know, and maybe moving out to the suburbs, buying a house. So it's hard to imagine Uber and Lyft, you know, getting them to their, you know, kids' soccer practice or to school every day. So I think there's still going to be a role for a vehicle, but it may be, you know, like I said, instead of, you know, a family having two cars, it's having one, for example, and maybe people, you know, young people putting off a bit longer when they buy their first vehicle. Mm-hmm. So that could lower demand a little bit.
What about the impacts of the tax bill? I know we talked a bit again in the questions and answers about home equity lending. What do you see as far as that, the driving of demand for individual types of loans or just people's appetite to spend?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, a tax cut in general fuels spending. You know, people have more money in their pockets, more money each month. They're going to spend a bit more. The one thing I will say, you know, the majority of the tax cuts did go to relatively wealthier folks. So they're not necessarily as likely to spend that right away. They might, you know, instead invest it or just save it. So it might not go immediately into the economy. So, you know, people kind of at the lower end of the income distribution also got some tax cuts, but wasn't quite as big. But I think it will, you know, increase a little bit of demand. You might see some people paying off some loan debt as well, and some spending, maybe, you know, getting some more vehicle loans, things like that.
Have we seen a reversal in the trend? I know that during the downturn, the average life of a vehicle, people were holding them longer. The average life of a vehicle on the road had kept going up to, I think, unprecedented levels. Yeah. Has that begun to recede at all? Is it turned around? Do you know? Or
don't know if that's part of your modeling.
Well, in the latest numbers I've seen, suggest no, it continues to go
up. Wow. I guess some of that's just the, you know, the dependability factor of the cars being built better as
better
well.
Quality cars, yeah. For sure.
So that you know, to some extent, maybe at some point that reverses. But, you know, with all the other factors going on, you can't be 100% certain. What about from a home equity standpoint? That was one of the questions. Tax incentives based on, you know, deductibility of mortgage interest and whether you're taking the standard or itemized deductions. Any, it sounds like you don't see that as a major impact at
this
stage.
The point I made is it's just really difficult to untangle all the variables. Mm-hmm. In an environment where home prices are going up and going up pretty quickly, the negative effects of lower, you know, benefits to, opting for that type of financing might be completely offset.
Zero themselves out.
By the fact that, yeah, there are plenty of people around still that are below water relative to pre-recession levels.
That's a good point.
And so, you know, to the extent home prices keep coming back, you'll have more and more people that are sort of eligible to get into that market. And those that have come back even in the last couple of years are probably now at the point where the pile of value that they have is high enough to start thinking about tapping. So,
and then more broadly from the sales standpoint, the prices go up, the interest rates go up, and therefore the amount of deductibility, you might get bumped above the threshold yet again.
Right, yep.
Well, great. Any other takeaways that you think our audience, have we missed anything? Have we touched on all the big ones?
I think we got most of the big ones. Can you think of anything, Jordan?
I would just, you know, recommend folks go to our website if interested in more information. Our presentation, I think, is up there. As well as we do have some updates to our regulatory burden study that's up there, well as calculators so people can calculate the estimated regulatory cost for each of their institutions, as well as, I don't know if you mentioned the calculator for the distribution as well.
Oh, yeah,
is up there.
That calculator's out there too.
And that direct address, cuna.org/economics. Economics. Great.
Yep.
Jordan Van Rijn, Mike Shank, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
So hopefully you found that interesting and valuable. One of the things that, the positive metrics are very clear, the continuing member growth of the base of credit union membership, and even more impressively, the loan growth that's been going on for some time now. Because I try to be as objective as I possibly can and kind of take a skeptic's view to this stuff sometime, I did ask the question. It's always interesting to me that, we talk about membership in credit unions, but the reality is that, you need to be a member in order to do business with a credit union. Auto lending does tend to be one of the active areas, and indirect auto lending in particular. When we talk about individuals not necessarily being aware that they are members of credit unions or having a great level of connection to them, my suspicion is that there is some subset of those members who have joined solely to get an auto loan and really don't intend to have any greater engagement than that. I'm looking to see, and hopefully we can get some numbers on that. Clearly, that is a piece that, if you stripped out of the numbers, would still show very impressive growth, but clearly that is a piece of the overall puzzle. I'd like to understand it better. In many ways, I think it could actually make the picture look even better, because if we could find a way to reach those people, that would be great. But it also says that if you netted them out of the denominator, our awareness and engagement with people who truly are bought into the credit union concept is even better yet. One of the other things, and this was mentioned as well by Mike and Jordan, was the Credit Union Stabilization Fund, the money that was set aside during the financial crisis to deal with any issues that popped up with loans that went bad, liquidations of institutions, and things along those lines. One of our other speakers was the chairman of the NCUA, the insurance body and regulatory body behind credit unions, Mark McWaters. And he reiterated the same thing that you heard from Mike and Jordan just now, that a $730 million payout rebate is coming to credit unions beginning this Q3. And what that reflects is the money that was set aside to deal with potential issues, fallout from the financial crisis, that wound up quite thankfully not to be entirely needed. So that will be coming back. And it's also meant that the pay, the individual payments of insurance premiums into that fund has been you know, been somewhat suppressed over time. So it's been good times from a credit union standpoint as far as that type of fixed costs that they have to deal with. Mr. McWaters also mentioned that, I thought this was interesting, that he has heard some stories of those rebates coming back to the credit unions, that some are stating their intent to donate those directly back into their communities for community impact. He pointed out one Members First Credit Union in Manchester, New Hampshire, as an example of that. And I guess you might think about that kind of the same way as you're seeing some of the proceeds of tax benefits through the new tax bill being redistributed by corporations in the form of bonuses to their employees. You might say that in terms of being somewhat similar. It was interesting because, I mean, that's obviously a very feel-good story. I did hear some rumblings in the hallway among a few people saying, yeah, that's nice, but it's also our money and it's the members' money. And maybe it ought to be going back to the members as well. The good answer there, the good news in my view, is there isn't a bad answer. I mean, either place it goes is definitely a good thing. So I think we'll see a little bit more about that as time goes on. And clearly, credit unions donating heavily into their communities already. Another message that Chairman McWaters mentioned was, it was kind of that standard, can't we all just get along kind of message, and really reinforcing something that I've been talking about for some time, which is the greater sense of common purpose that credit unions and community banks have. There's a lot more that unite them than divide them. And if we could find ways to actually, you know, lock arms and work together on some of these things, I think it would be best for all concerned. The other big piece that I want to highlight, and I was going to try to interview Teresa Freeborn from Exceed Credit Union, who was the chairperson of the of CUNA's awareness campaign, and did a great presentation on stage about this. Unfortunately, our calendars just didn't match up, but I will try to do the message justice based on the notes that I took down while listening to her presentation, along with some help from some PR and advertising agency folks who have been working on this as well. And this is, again, the whole message of building credit union awareness more broadly across the U.S. population. Very data-driven exercise that they went through. This is not just a matter of kind of, you know, checking where the winds are blowing and coming up with, I think this might work. They tested a lot of different hypotheses, have talked to, I believe they said, thousands of focus groups to get a sense for what resonated, what messages needed to be reinforced, what really kind of, you know, got the proper response. The one thing that I took away, and Jim Nussle made these comments as well in his opening remarks, is that the two biggest myths and perceptions or misperceptions that credit unions continue to need to overcome is that, one, an individual says, yeah, I'm just not eligible to join. I'm not a credit union is not available to me. And the other one is a perception that it's great for local work, but I can't really use it if I really want to work, you know, do banking outside my direct community. If I travel, I might run into a problem. I won't be able to use an ATM. I won't have access to my money, whatever. It's kind of the downside in my mind of the message that we've done such a great job of, you know, of locality and customer intimacy. I think there just winds up becoming an assumption along those lines that if you're that good at being kind of down home, you must not have the national reach. So those are the two things that the belief is that we really have to overcome. What's not there, which is really interesting, is the whole notion of awareness of what a credit union is and a general favorable disposition toward credit unions. What the research that this group did showed is that those two metrics are already in pretty good shape. So we don't have to really worry about, you know, reinforcing those too much. We can kind of assume that they're already there. What they do believe is that we need to build top of mind consideration, really establishing credit unions as a smart choice when it comes time for a consumer to think about making a financial decision around how to receive their financial services, so that we're right there in the mix in terms of how they're going to make that decision. So with that, the awareness campaign shared some ideas that they came up with and some original pieces that they're about to start rolling out. And they really took pains to reinforce the idea that this is not intended to replace any branding and marketing that credit unions do individually. It's really to supplement. It's an umbrella image campaign that then can be taken down to a local level and an individual brand level. It's in support. The example they gave, which I think made a lot of sense, is the NFL does broad advertising, but then individual teams will go a step further in terms of really, you know, taking that message to their, you know, their individual markets, to their individual attributes. So with that in mind, the idea that they are pitching is a campaign with the slogan, "Open your eyes to a credit union." Some pretty impressive stuff, and I'm sure you'll be hearing about more of this from CUNA as time goes forward. They do have a website set up, which you can take a look at, and it is www.awareness.creditunion, which, by the way, is another initiative that was talked about, a new set of domains with .creditunion as opposed to .org or .com, and those are now available for credit unions to take those on as new domain names. And that this is an example of one of those, www.awareness.creditunion. It is a password-protected site, but I was told it was okay to share it just among us. If you go and enter in the password, open your eyes, OpenYoureEyes. As far as I know, that's all lowercase. You will get into the site and have an opportunity to take a look at the collaterals and materials that already exist. And I think it's worth the time. There's some interesting stuff out there. So we'll post some links as well on the show notes. But do take a look. I think it's time well spent. And again, I think hitting all the right notes with regard to messaging. So the last session I attended at GAC, and I really want to commend CUNA for giving the visibility and the stage time to this one. And this was actually mentioned by somebody directly from the floor. Very well attended session. I'd say probably a good 250 people or so who were there. The title of the session was Cannabis, Credit Unions, and Service to Communities. And, you know, what it comes down to, and this is something we've talked a bit about before, and it's a topic that's just so easy for people to kind of make jokes about, and it is dead serious. I mean, this is really big and important stuff. When you think about the fact that we've taken an industry, created a legal structure that says that it is now legal in 29 states, whether for recreational or medicinal needs, that means that there is the legal ability to transact with cannabis byproducts. But we have not followed up with the banking laws to allow that to happen. And we have a disconnect between state and federal law as well. So it creates this just bizarre, you know, neither here nor there kind of situation that prevents these organizations from becoming fully legitimized by working within the confines of the banking system, which frankly creates a very dangerous situation, as we'll talk about. In fact, we talk a lot about the unbanked and the underbanked is when it comes to consumers. I would say that in many cases that these businesses are the unbankable, I think is maybe a term that we might want to start using on this. One of the things that I just want to point out, I mean, this was a very serious topic. There was no joking around. I mean, when I looked around the room, talk about, you know, shattering stereotypes, I did not see, you know, any Grateful Dead overhang and, you know, tie-dye or, you know, aging hippies or young people looking for, you know, something, you know, a nice recreational kind of chance to just kind of think about how they can get around the law. This was a very serious suit and tie crowd. And you could tell from the credentials of the people on the podium as well. Former lieutenant staff member from the lieutenant governor of Colorado, former law lawyer at Holland and Knight, also somebody who worked in government affairs, somebody with a consulting background at major brand marketing firms. And again, this is very serious stuff, and I think it was great that we had a meaningful conversation on it. One of the things, and the real kind of, I'd say the centerpiece to the conversation, was a woman by the name of Rachel Pross, who we'll hear from in just a moment. She's one of the two people I wound up interviewing, along with Shanita Penny from Budding Solutions, a consulting advisory firm to help set up these shops. Rachel is the chief risk officer of MAPS Credit Union in Salem, Oregon. They had moved into the space of providing banking services through their credit union to members operating licensed cannabis dispensaries over the course of, I believe they started in 2014 was what she told me. And Just as a coincidence, I had a conversation with the CEO of that credit union at Filene's Big Bright Minds event back in December. And I remember thinking, oh, man, I really want to follow up with this gentleman. It was a fascinating conversation. I didn't know if he would be interested in going on the record. And obviously, they are comfortable speaking, given that Rachel was here on the podium talking. One of the things that they talked about, and this is what kind of a recurring theme, is it becomes a public safety issue. I mean, we are, you know, again, we've moved this business in out of the shadows. It's in a situation where it can be regulated. There was a lot of talk about tracking from seed to sale, an actual database that allows you to really see the entire chain of custody to make sure that things are entirely legal. But then at the end of the day, you can't use a credit card. It's a cash business. And the amount of cash being generated is not a very safe thing. Talk about sitting targets if you want to look for an easy opportunity for theft and crime is if you've got big chunks of cash lying around in certain places. Example of that, Andrew Friedman, who was formerly, as I mentioned, he was known as the marijuana czar from the lieutenant governor's staff in the state of Colorado, really took the lead in rolling out, you know, the regulatory environment to enable the legalization of marijuana in a structured fashion in their state. He mentioned that Colorado generated an annual tax inflow of $250 million. That implies a $1.5 billion business in the state of Colorado alone in cash. I mean, just think about that. That's all cash, pretty much by definition. Somebody's got to be working with that cash. You're, you know, as he also gave the example, imagine these are people who are paying these taxes. Those taxes are showing up at the tax office on tax day. It doesn't make a lot of sense to be doing this all in cash. It's so much more rational to be doing it through a legitimate banking system. And that's the conversation we had. And the piece that was, I think, really valuable to understand is the degree of compliance, professional project management, and robust systems that were put around this. As Rachel had mentioned, all of their clients are hungry for additional guidance and control. They want to come above board. They want to be able to do this, and they are hungry for people to tell them how to make that happen. So, you know, there's not an issue of people looking to skirt the law. In fact, there's a very much kind of a zero tolerance policy around this, where if there's any idea that you're not going along with the program and trying to hide anything, you will lose your banking account very quickly. And I don't think these institutions or these companies want to do that. So it just keeps them that much more, you know, doing this as legitimately as possible. One of the things that was very interesting, again, talked about here is that, you know, Rachel said, as they got approval from their board to engage in this this exercise, one of the key points was they needed to have an exit plan. So if anything wound up going awry, that they could extricate themselves from the business as quickly as possible and as effectively as possible. And they nearly had that type of a situation back in January. As you recall, Attorney General Sessions effectively revoked what was referred to as the Cole memo, which was pretty much not, it wasn't binding, but it was basically the comfort letter that was provided that gave these institutions the comfort that the federal government was not going to come after them for violating federal law. There's also, as you'll hear in the details in the conversation, something called FinCEN guidance, which is actually governed by the Department of Treasury. That is still what they're hanging their hat on in providing these services. And that wound up not being rescinded, which is where, you know, we wind up being where the determination is made. This is still a viable business that you can be in. But as Rachel pointed out, the day that the Cole memo was revoked, she effectively, you know, executed and began, you know, setting up, taking steps to execute on the exit plan, which involved getting $30 million of cash from the Federal Reserve to have that on order so that if they needed to close out all these accounts, again, you're closing the accounts, no one else can take the accounts. How are you going to give them the money? You're going to give them the money in cash. She had to have $30 million of cash on hand if that were to be necessary. Wound up not being necessary, but again, just a fee, you know, if you can have that big of an impact for one credit union in Salem, Oregon to unwind, just picture what else is going on in the marketplace. Anyway, I don't think I'm stealing the thunder. Hopefully, I'm just kind of setting things up. Great conversation here with Shanita Penny and Rachel Pross from MAPS Credit Union. Have a listen.
Glenn Cervata here at CUNA GAC. Just had a really, really interesting conversation about cannabis banking here with two of the panelists who are there on the stage. Shanita Penny from Budding Solutions, CEO, consulting firm and background in consulting with major brand marketing at Late Man Brands, as I understand. And Rachel Cross, Chief Risk Officer for MAPS Credit Union, which has really taken the lead in a lot of banking of cannabis companies up in Oregon, where it is legal. And, you know, one of the things we talked about is that this is not a conversation that has to do with pro, con in terms of legalization. The bottom line is, when cannabis is legal, there is a significant public safety issue around the need. And to me, again, my editorializing, kind of ridiculous if you're talking about a legal activity, then to prevent someone from being able to use the banking system, it prevents them from being able to be a truly legitimate business. Any thoughts along those lines? I think that's really what, Rachel, what's brought you into this business, correct?
Sure. When our board voted to do this, it wasn't an issue of whether or not we felt cannabis should be legal. It was an issue of the fact that it is legal in the state of Oregon, and it creates a major problem having that much cash on the street. So our board chose in 2014 to enter this industry primarily for two reasons. One was community safety, and the other was serving the underserved, which is what credit unions are all about.
And again, the underserved in this case being the companies that
correct
are underserved.
Correct.
And you had given some numbers, the amount of money floating around in the
There's
in
a
the
lot
community.
Of money floating around. In 2017, my credit union MAPS in Salem took in $180 million in cash in 2017 alone off our streets.
That is phenomenal. And Shanita, you mentioned also in terms of the clients that you work with, that definitely something that you've seen as far as the need to really kind of bring these businesses out of the shadows, correct?
Absolutely. And while it has evolved over the last 3 years, we are still in need of full banking services. So while we're paying a premium for, banking access, we still can't write checks. We still can't take out small business loans. The other piece is that it limits capital access for minorities. Minorities have been disproportionately affected by the war on drugs and are now being kept out of this legal industry because of something as small as access to capital.
And I believe you mentioned that in terms of access to capital, startup costs are pretty significant. If you
Absolutely.
Want to actually make this into a legitimate business, and unless you know an angel investor or have those kind of contacts of deep pockets, that is a pretty big limitation if you can't go to someplace to receive funding.
Right. When you have the great idea of jumping into the cannabis industry, unless you've got $1 million to $2 million, you can't even get through the licensing process. By the time you hire consultants and get property and equipment, it's just not realistic.
Mm-hmm. And Rachel, you made it pretty clear. I mean, you are really, squeaky clean on this stuff. And clearly you find that your customers, your members who are actually in the business, actually welcome that level of scrutiny as well, because they're trying to be above board.
They do. I think the more compliance requirements that we give them, the happier they are, because it reinforces the fact that they are legitimate businesses that are legal in the state of Oregon.
And you also talked a little bit, obviously, it's a very high-touch, labor-intensive business on your side, which obviously you said that there's a need, obviously, for this business to pay for itself. So you are generating a profit on this, too.
Sure. We make sure that the business is able to fund having this program in our credit union. It's very labor-intensive. It's one employee for every 30 to 40 accounts.
Which compares, I think you said, usually it's more like one to every 200 or so?
It's a significant difference. It varies by credit union, but just by comparison, our credit union has 60,000 members, mm-hmm, and about 250 employees. And when it comes to this specific program, it's one employee for every 30 to 40 accounts.
Wow.
So it's very high touch, intense monitoring. It also required investment in an anti-money laundering software to be able to make sure that those transactions are above board and aggregated appropriately.
And I think you mentioned that that's one of the benefits to the credit union as a whole, is this line of business then wound up funding for the entire credit union.
It sure did. It also funded our enterprise risk management platform, and it's enhanced our Bank Secrecy Act awareness across the whole organization.
And you also gave some examples, Shanita, because again, this means you're going to have higher, fees to cover these things. And you mentioned some of the fees in terms of startup.
Sure. Here in Maryland, we paid $3,000 to open the account, and our monthly service fee is $1,750.
Which sounds pretty hefty, but obviously a business that, the alternative is working entirely in cash.
Right. And a lot of times we're paying these fees before we're even generating any revenue.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been in the business entirely primarily in Maryland, or you?
No, my application and licensing experience is in D.C., Maryland, Pennsylvania, and now Arkansas.
Oh, okay.
And have clients all over the country that are not plant touching or ancillary businesses.
Okay. If that was the other phrase that I'd never heard before, is seed to sale. I guess that's important to really keep that closed loop where you could really see the entire process.
Definitely. And make sure there's not diversion to the black market. It's primary reason, or diversion across state lines.
Okay. The one other thing, and just make sure if people are not familiar with it already, the reason that credit unions, and this is not at all a risk-free proposition, we've made that clear as well, and you had some pretty good agita, Rachel, on your side as well. You know, the Cole memo, which is, again, gets kind of into inside baseball, was, you know, provides coverage for, you know, providing the service, because there's a disconnect between federal law and state law. And then you are a state chartered credit union, correct?
Correct. And the Cole memo was actually revoked completely in the first week of January. But the priorities of the Cole memo were spelled out in the FinCEN guidance. And the FinCEN guidance still stands, and Treasury oversees FinCEN guidance.
And that's the piece that really is the remaining foundation on which credit unions
Correct.
Can continue to rely.
That's our compliance framework.
And you mentioned that one other thing that's important is to have an exit strategy in place. Because
Absolutely.
If something is, you know, potentially could go wrong, or in terms of change of the political winds, you have to be able to unwind.
Absolutely. And it should be very specific and spelled out and scheduled. It should include caps on deposit volumes so that you don't run into any type of liquidity issues if you had to exit quickly, security, all of those thoughts. It's a pretty comprehensive strategy, but we began to test it when the Cole memo was revoked. And it
you had the benefit of the extra time on the West Coast.
It was a great disaster test. It was great.
You said it was like 5 a.m. You started getting pinged.
5 a.m. started getting texts.
Wow. Sinead, any trends that you've seen in terms of your clients? Anything, you know, are they becoming larger as far as the people coming to you looking to set up shop? Or any change as far as, you know, as this becomes somewhat more mainstream and more, I believe it's 29 states, did we say now, that now have, whether it's recreational or medicinal permission?
No, the same people are wanting to get involved, and now we're able to help a larger group of people who didn't have access before. So the smaller mom and pops, there's legislation around micro licensing and things like that. So when you start talking about that barrier of entry that is raising capital, those micro licenses are much smaller, don't require the $1 million. And so from a regulatory standpoint or a legislative standpoint, we're addressing it there.
And I forget if it was one of you who made the comment. I mean, we're not talking about the old stereotype of somebody doing this in their garage. We're talking about some very professional organizations, former lawyers, former consulting professionals as yourself. So it's a very different ballgame.
It really is.
Yeah.
It is not what you're picturing in your mind when you hear a cannabis business. These are legitimate business owners who have demonstrated, for me at least, a really strong desire to be transparent and on the up and up with their activities.
Well, Shanita Penny, Rachel Prost, thank you very much for taking the time. If people want to get in touch with you, any contact information you'd like to provide?
Sure. spenny@buddingsolutions.net. You can get in touch with me directly.
Wonderful.
And rprost@mapcu.com.
Great. And I'll post your information also on our show notes as well. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, so hopefully we'll have a lot more. I find it to be an absolutely fascinating and extremely relevant topic. Any thoughts you have, any more, you know, leads you have as far as people who might have a perspective to share, I think would be very interesting. Again, you know, the comment that was made is that, you know, the whole notion of providing these services is not a pro or anti stance around the legalization of marijuana and cannabis. It is a public safety stance saying, if it is going to be legal, we need to be able to do it effectively. And that was the point that, that Rachel made. And she also made the point that it was not a unanimous approved approach, that there was some level of discomfort from some of their members, but nothing too dramatic from that standpoint. And it has been a product that has paid for itself in terms of the service line. It was also made clear, I mean, these are people all on stage who are advocating for doing something in this direction, but it's not for the weak of heart. This is not absolutely fail-safe territory. So if you do choose to go down this path from a, you know, community service, public safety argument, be aware that there are risks involved. So I hate to even say that, because I'd like to see more people find a way to legitimize this business, but that has to be something that you're aware of. Anyway, love to hear from you. You can reach me at at 154 Advisors. That's on Twitter. At JB Fintech is how you can reach John Best as part of the Best Innovation Group. We'll be back again very soon with more information. I'll be heading off to London for Finovate Europe, and we'll have some reports from there coming up. Also have some an interview coming up with NACHA around their NACHA Payments Conference, which is taking place in late April, early May out in San Diego. Until then, thanks for listening, and see you soon.
Got a question or want to join the conversation? We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at Big Fintech, email us at info@big-fintech.com, or visit our show notes and comments at www.bigfintechmedia.com.